Well, Friday will be a historic day for inter-Korean relations. The leaders of both nations, both North and South, will meet for the first time in 11 years and for the first time on the southern side of the demilitarized zone. It's also the first time Kim Jong-un will meet a South Korean leader. Now, the meeting follows Kim Jong-un's trip to Beijing. That's where he met the Chinese president, Xi Jinping. That was late last month. And it's also a few weeks away from his meeting with President Donald Trump. That's the first time the leaders of the US and North Korea will meet. Now, Kim has announced that North Korea would suspend any further nuclear tests and would shut down a site where past nuclear tests have been conducted. So to the ordinary observer, it would seem that the North Koreans are making sincere efforts to improve relations with their southern neighbour, and even the United States. But to the seasoned observer, this is a path we've been down before, and North Korean declarations about denuclearization and gestures of goodwill certainly can't be taken at face value. Kathy Moon is one of those seasoned observers of inter-Korean relations. She's a professor of political science at Wesley College and a non-resident senior fellow in foreign policy at the Center for East Asia Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Kathy, welcome back to Between the Lines.
Hi, thanks a lot.
Now, first, take us back to the last two inter-Korean meetings, which happened in 2007 and 2000. What eventuated from those meetings?
Well, the one in 2007 was the big bash, the big splash. President Kim Dae-jung of the liberal persuasion and in South Korea, and by that it means not so conservative, a little bit more eased on national security, more efforts on social justice. So Kim Dae-jung, who had been a dissident for many, many decades during South Korea's authoritarian rule, he becomes president in 1997 and works to make this 2000 summit possible in June. Kim Jong-il, the deceased father of the current leader, Kim Jong-un, met him in Pyongyang. The two got off very, very swimmingly, I would say, and lots of smiles, lots of toasts, and it had several effects. For the South Korean president, it was a way to make real his engagement policy called the Sunshine Policy, to work with North Korea in terms of joint ventures, other economic programs, and to ease up the security threats on both sides of the DMZ and try to increase some people-to-people relations through conferences, cultural exchange, and pave a very slow path toward reunification. For Kim Jong-il at the time in 2000, basically, he was just had been working with the U.S. in terms of the agreed framework back in 94, 95. He was also riding a situation where he needed some extra boosting.
At this meeting, we've got the two countries. I mean, they may discuss formally ending the Korean War, which of course ended 65 years ago, but a peace treaty was never signed. So that'll probably entail North Korea demanding the removal of US military bases in and around the Korean Peninsula. Surely that's not something that the South Koreans are going to agree to, is it?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, when Kim Dae-jung, the South Korean president, went to North Korea in 2000, Kim Jong-il, the leader of North Korea at the time, had basically said that it would be okay. He could live with the U.S. bases remaining in South Korea for two reasons. One, relations between the North and South, and also to maintain stability in the region. So that was a surprising statement. Right now, Kim Jong-un is sending signs that the U.S. will not be, quote, required to remove its troops, etc. But of course, if the two Koreas sign a peace treaty or an agreement, there would have to be logically some modification of the U.S. presence, because you wouldn't really have the justification with a peace inter-Korean peace agreement to have close to 30,000 troops and forward deployed and the anti-missile defense system. I think more than likely Kim Jong-un will try to figure out if the removal of THAAD, the U.S. anti-missile defense system, might be negotiable. But I don't think they're going to push for the removal of troops.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the Chinese would like that too, the removal of THAAD. But last week, it was interesting that the North Koreans announced it has suspended any further nuclear and intercontinental ballistic missile tests, and they'll close down a site where past nuclear tests have been conducted. But, I mean, how meaningful is that pledge to suspend all of these tests and sites and closing this underground nuclear facility when we've had reports this week that North Korea's underground nuclear test site is said to be largely unusable, according to Chinese scientists?
Yes, I think you've answered your own question. The question is, how sincere are they? And we went through this in another round back in 2008 when George W. Bush was ready to lift a sanction, basically, which was the U.S. act that called the North Korean state a supporter of terrorism. And the government, U.S. government, was willing to open up some relations with North Korea. And the North Koreans blew up a cooling tower in their nuclear site. And so it was a big splash, again, visually, but there were reports that the tower was so old, so antiquated, and that it was not really functional anyway. So we don't know if these gestures are more for show. We don't know if these gestures cover up some, you know, other sites of nuclear testing and nuclear advancement that the U.S. and South Korea would be interested in. But I think in general, the North Koreans are trying hard in their own way to send, you know, we call it signaling. They're trying to signal that they do want to improve relations. What the terms of those, that the improvement will be, we don't know yet.
Okay, now on this program last year, following North Korea's, I think it was its sixth nuclear test, you argued that far from being crazy, Kim is prudent and calculating. So the question here is, why would Kim suddenly express an openness towards denuclearization and closer diplomatic ties to not just the South, but also to Beijing and Washington?
Well, it's a good question, and I stand by my statement last year, you have a better memory than I, that Kim Jong-un and his regime is quite rational. And I think actually the events that have been unfolding since New Year's Day, when he declared his interest in having North Korean athletes go to South Korea's Winter Olympic game, and all of the negotiations and fanfare that took place during the Olympic Games, I think these incidents or events, rather, actually prove my point. North Koreans in general, the leaders, they do not do things off the cuff. Things are highly, highly planned and orchestrated. And many of us experts look at the recent events since January 1st as having originated much earlier, most likely at least a year, if not more. And that the desire to reach out to South Korea and the U.S. was building among the elites, and that the elites in North Korea were waiting for both a good timing and occasion, like the Pyeongchang Olympics, as well as a fully consolidated agreement that that Pyongyang wants to explore a different path. In terms of specific reasons, you know, many believe that the U.S. and UN-based sanctions against North Korea was a big factor in squeezing the economy. I think it's debatable, but that's a credible factor. Another reason is that the North actually had even stated in December 2017 that Kim Jong-un said he's satisfied. He's satisfied with the level of nuclear development and that now it's time to focus on economic development. And that has been the North Korean official policy from the early period of Kim Jong-un's regime, both economic and military development. And now, you know, the other side is supposed to get some sunlight or limelight. So we'll see if he's really trying to pursue and reform reform the economy.
And what about the role of the United States here? Because throughout last year, the president, Donald Trump, would all too often talk a hawkish language, threatening fire and fury, raising the prospect of a preemptive strike on the North Koreans. Well, can he say with some justification that he's showing that his maximum pressure campaign has brought North Korea to heel?
You know, that's what Mr. Trump claims and believes. And I think the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, has done an incredible job of basically straddling North Korea and the United States. And the South Korean president's the one who started off giving this public high praise to Mr. Trump for allegedly making the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics and the peaceful reunion of the North and South happen. But you know, we don't know how much it actually was credible. I mean, North Koreans have been living with U.S. threats, whether it's highly rhetorical or quietly real, for decades and decades. I think what did it was the South Koreans were more afraid of Trump's rhetoric than they were of North Korea's possibility of launching nuclear missiles against the South. So it actually gave a lot of momentum. The fire and fury talk gave a lot of momentum to the South Korean government to try to calm down Mr. Trump and create a situation on the peninsula that would be more manageable so that Trump doesn't have to jack up the rhetoric one more time and possibly actually have the rhetoric escalate into military force on the peninsula.
Just quickly before we go, how surprising was it that the president dispatched secretly the CIA director, who's going to be the incoming Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, this covert trip to North Korea over Easter to meet Kim Jong-un? Have we ever experienced this before in the history between North Korea and the United States, where such a high-level US official has met with the leader of North Korea?
No, not before any agreement.
That's extraordinary.
Right. But on the other hand, Madeleine Albright went to North Korea in order to pave the way for Bill Clinton to visit Pyongyang right before he ended his term in office. So we do have not a parallel, but we do have a precedent of sorts. But I think in this case, it's unique for different reasons, not just that we sent the head of the CIA who's up for being Secretary of State, but also that North Koreans, they talk intelligence. They're very secretive. I think they would take seriously what the head of the US CIA would say. So I think in terms of the stature and status of that position, being a position and a job that the North Korean leadership understands, I think that was actually a smart move on the part of Trump. I also think that Mr. Trump was setting up Mr. Pompeo. This was like a runway model preview, showing him off and what he can do diplomatically before presenting him, before he's up for Senate confirmation in its full glory and scrutiny.
That was Kathy Moon, professor of political science at Wesley College and a non-resident senior fellow in foreign policy at the Center for East Asia Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington.